Accession number 18795, Reel 3.
It's Tony Wilcox, Reel 2. Anyway, can you describe to me a bit what Kuwait was like in those days in 1949?
Well, when we landed in Kuwait, Kuwait Airport consisted of two EPIP, don't ask me what EPIP stands for, but two EPIP tents. It's a type of tent. I think it's an Indian designation. And they were in the process of putting up a mud hut there. There was no runway, of course. I mean, it was a sand strip. And we flew out on chartered aircraft largely, and they were Skymasters, I think they were. And you spent one night en route in London, I think mostly in Beirut, but not always, sometimes in Damascus. It was still possible, and I wish I had been able to do it, it was still possible to go to Kuwait by flying boat. And you could fly from Southampton to Marignan near Marseille, and you spent a night there. And then the next day you flew from Marignan to the Nile, Cairo. And the third day you flew to Kuwait, and you landed in the Bay of Kuwait, just offshore of the town. So it was still fairly early days in Kuwait. There was a tarmac road, a surface road, blacktop we called it, from Kuwait town to Ahmadi.
Already established, Ahmadi was.
Ahmadi was established to the extent that they had built some PMQs, which permanent married quarters, which were concrete block construction. But the rest of the town was Nissen huts, things called archons, which again not dissimilar from Nissen huts. But there was a big building program going on.
And it was an area called Situfoam.
Sorry?
Situfoam.
Situfoam was a camp. Situfoam was again, I think, a patented. It was sprayed concrete, basically. That was my brother lived in Situpoam for a time. I lived in a tented camp in Ahmadi for my first week while they were organizing things, and then moved down to the drilling field at Wara, which was again initially a tented camp. Those who had been there longer had progress to either what was called a callow hut, which was a mud-built hut, individual rooms, I think 10 rooms to a block with a separate ablutions block, rather like in some of the army camps, and or to the real Nissen hut, which again, I think it was about 8 rooms to a block, separate ablution, but no air conditioning or anything civilized like that.
Now, Wara was at the northern end of the Burgan Field, wasn't it?
Wara was at the northern end of the Burgan Field, that's
next
right.
Next to Kuwait's only hill.
That is right, yeah. And the camp was, I suppose, a good 80% American, because, I mean, there were very few oil rig trained workers from the UK. And we were assigned to an American driller, Roscoe Armstrong, who was a super chap. The only problem was that he was a Texan, and his crew consisted of an American derrick man, and what we called, as I said, 5 white coolies. Now, the white coolies were all ex-forces. There were two Australians, Fish Allwood and Phil Whiting. One was a squadron leader and the other a flight lieutenant from the Australian IR. Sam Bulbeck had been a temporary colonel in the Indian Army. I'm trying to think of the others, but they were all had been officers in during the war, and like me, no qualifications, and starting at the bottom. Some with perhaps less intention of staying on in the oil industry than others. Some were there because in those days it was a good salary. It was a lot more than you could earn at home. Had I taken a job, for example, in a bank in England in those days, I would have started at about £1.10 a week. Going to Kuwait, my initial salary was £50 a month, which was certainly better than £1.10 a week, as well as being paid £50 a month, we had completely free board and accommodation. So that £50 was spending money. So,
and it was tax-free.
And it was tax-free, that's right. Some of them were there for that reason. Others had in mind that they were going to make a career. I was one of those who was known as a 15-year man. One of those who began to try and make a career in the oil industry. And it was interesting working with the Americans, because the Americans were real oil field workers. Now, Roscoe had a very, very strong Texan accent, and it was very difficult to understand him at times. And I can well remember many occasions when we got out onto the rig floor and Roscoe would be giving us our instructions for the shift, as it were, and we would all sit round him saying, yes, nodding our heads wisely, and when he finished, we'd go off into our own little huddle and try and decipher what he'd been trying to tell us, which wasn't always that easy.
Yeah.
It wasn't always that easy. And, of course, strangely enough, few of them were... they weren't totally illiterate, but many of them were verging on illiteracy and weren't able to write, for example, so that come the end of the shift, one or other of the white coolies would have to fill in the drilling report for them. We were told what to put down, but they couldn't write. But it was interesting, and as I say, he was a super chap, Roscoe. I mean, he was my first... apart from my army career, he was my first boss, as it were, and very different from anything that I'd experienced in the army.
A rig floor is a very physical place.
Oh, entirely.
And it's a very dangerous place.
It's entirely a physical place. It is skilled labour.
Mm. And you learnt on the job.
That's right. Yes, very much so.
When you did a round trip, which meant pulling a length of pipe out of the hole, when you got down to the maximum depth of the well, presumably in the early days, it took quite a long time.
It was hard work. It was very hard physical labour.
And in the heat.
The daytime temperature in the shade would vary between 115 and 125 in the shade. There wasn't any real shade out in the desert. And probably what was worse in some senses was that if you were working a night shift, what the Americans called the graveyard tower, they called it tower, you came back into the camp at about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and you had something to eat, and then you went to try and sleep. And, of course, in an Nissen hut, trying to sleep without any air conditioning during the day with 126 or 120, say, on average, 120 in the shade. And Nissen hut was in no shade, and the sun beating down on the metal roof of a Nissen hut, it got fairly hot. And not all that easy to sleep. I think the other thing that one recalls is that we had, in those days, quite a few sandstorms, many, many more than they have nowadays, not because the climate has changed, but because with the ready availability of oil, petrol, gas, kerosene, the local inhabitants no longer went out into the desert to collect all the scrub, which they brought in for fuel. And so the desert was reseeding itself, and gradually there was more and more scrub, and therefore the winds didn't churn up as much sand as they had in the past, and you get far fewer sandstorms these days than you did in the past. But I can remember in the teeth of a sandstorm, having moved from a tent into the Nissen hut by then, coming back and getting a block of ice. Ice was readily available from the ice plant, and we used to have a large block of ice, which was, I suppose, about 2 feet high by about 9 inches square, and putting my mosquito net over the bed and over a chair, and putting the chair at the bottom of the bed with a fan behind it, and spending the day with the fan blowing cooled air over me under the mosquito net.
Which, over the block of ice.
Which, yeah. Over the block of ice. We had what we called desert coolers, which you can still buy. You still see them advertised, which basically were boxes with straw over which water was dripped, and a fan. So you were basically cooling the air by making it very humid. You were reducing the temperature by, I suppose, what?
Did you have 10 degrees. Did you have
many
accidents on the rigs? In view of your low level of skill to begin with, anyway.
Remarkably few. Mm. Remarkably few. The most dangerous single thing on the floor of a rig was spinning the chain, which is used to tighten up each stand of drill pipe. As you were going into the hole, one stand of pipe, which was about 30 feet of pipe, which was quite heavy, it was heavy gauge steel, had to be screwed into the next. And this was done initially by throwing up a chain and pulling on the cat head, which is a sort of winch, and as the cat head drew in the chain, so the chain wrapped round the pipe, spun the pipe, and then it was finished by putting on tongs, which were clamped onto the pipe, and again with a rope onto the cat head being a drum head, and tightening it up that way. I think fingers being caught in the chain was the most serious. I didn't like being on the floor at all. On the other hand, it didn't worry me climbing. So I very quickly volunteered to go up into the derrick and work on what they called the monkey board. And that meant you were away from the rig floor, but you were some 90 feet up in the air.
You were top man.
A what?
Top man.
Top man? No, derrick man.
Oh, derrick man.
Derrick man. Mm. And you worked on this little monkey board, pulling the pipes out of the rack, or putting them back into the rack if you were coming out of the hole. I found I got quite good at that. And eventually, of course, the driller got more confidence in the way in which we could operate, and we were actually allowed to work the draw heads itself, which was more interesting, because you send the block hurtling up into the derrick and bringing it down with another piece of pipe. So there weren't that many. I mean, one learnt to be careful. You don't need too many accidents to make everybody very wary.
You were on Bergen 49, that was your first?
I started on Bergen 49, yeah.
And how long were you drilling?
I was in drilling for just over a year, and at that time we had a system called... At that time everybody was out there for a three-year contract, and after a three-year contract they went home for 6 months' leave. And if somebody on the administrative side goes home for 6 months' leave, they are replaced. And I was asked if I would be interested in taking a job as a leave replacement in the administrative side in industrial relations, in fact, in what was called the clerical, CF&T, clerical foreman and technical staff, basically Indian and Pakistanis. And I did that for 6 months, which is very interesting.
Clerical
foreman and technical. The clerical staff were almost entirely Indian. The technical and foreman were almost entirely Pakistanis. There were a few Goanese out there, but not many, basically. So I worked in that for 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months, they said, well, now, would you be interested in a job doing... And somebody else had gone on 6 months' leave, reception and indoctrination. And I said, well, yes, that sounds interesting. That meant that I was in charge of meeting all the new staff at the airport as they came in and having them for 5 days while I told them all about Kuwait, what they could expect, what the... it was just a general indoctrination on life in Kuwait for 5 days.
And you had air-conditioned offices by this time?
I had an air-conditioned office by that time, but not air-conditioned accommodation.
Were you still down in
Sydney? No. I moved from from Wara into the precincts camp. Now, precincts was, again, it was like Sitifoam, but brick-built rather than concrete block-built. Which eventually both of them, the Sitifoam became artisan quarters, and precincts became Indian and Pakistani staff.
So this was what later became South Ahmadi.
That's right. Became South Ahmadi. Yeah, yes, indeed.
Towards the tank farm.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then again, one was working in the head office area. One knew who was going when, and one got summer bride accommodation. And people went home, and we lived in houses, some of which were beginning to be air conditioned because they were just about completing the chilled water plant. But that was none of the cars, of course, were air conditioned. What else? Yes, I did that, and then I was very lucky in that they said, would you like to go and learn Arabic? And I said, well, I'd love to go and learn Arabic. So I was sent home. I did 6 weeks at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and then went out to Shumlan in the Lebanon, inland from Beirut, up in the mountains, and spent 7 months there learning proper Arabic, the written language and spoken language.
That was the Middle East Centre for Arabic Studies.
That was the Middle East Centre of Arabic Studies, which was run by the Foreign Office, which all the locals called the spy school. In fact, it wasn't a spy school at all. It was basically for foreign service, new entries into the foreign service who were likely to be needing Arabic in their foreign service careers. Typical foreign service, of course, at the end of every course, all the foreign service people were posted to Europe or America, never to the Middle East. But I mean, that was to be expected, I think.
So it's a pretty intensive course.
It's a very intensive course, and surprising how... I mean, here we are, what, 40 years later, and we had a holiday in Morocco, and still quite a lot of the Arabic sticks. But again, the interesting thing was, having completed that course, that 9 months full-time study of Arabic, I went back to Kuwait, and a friend rang me up and said, "Tony, gosh, you speak Arabic, do come and help me, please. I've just knocked over a donkey. And I've got a Bedou here, and I need help." So I went down quickly, and the Bedou couldn't understand a word I said, and I couldn't understand a word the Bedou said. So much for Arabic. The form of Arabic that I had learnt was the sort of Arabic which could be understood by the educated people, whether they were in Lebanon, Egypt, Tunisia, or wherever. And the Bedouin language is a very... It is Arabic, but it's
Arabic.
Yes. It's a dialect. Yeah. Yes.
Do you want to take a break here, Tony? What came after the indoctrination period, then?
After indoctrination, I was moved to the Labour Office. No, I'm wrong. After the indoctrination, I was sent home to London to work in De Candolle's office, which was the government... De Candolle was the government relations advisor. And I was the London end of the government relations office.
This is KOC head office.
This was KOC's head office what used to be number one Great Cumberland Place before they moved to Burghant House. That was interesting.
What did it involve?
It was really the sort of the discussions with the ruler and with other members of the ruling family on Kuwait, on the Kuwait Oil Company concession. Because the original concession was based on a gold sovereign a ton, I think it was, and of course it had moved on to a share of the profits, plus a small royalty, it was interesting to follow. I don't recall great in any detail now, but interesting to follow the course of events there. In those days, they were friendly negotiations. I mean, there was no antagonism, but it was the Aramco in Saudi Arabia had led the way, and really it was leading Kuwait gently along the Aramco path. Put it the other way, it was the Kuwaitis leading the Kuwait Oil Company gently along the Aramco path. But they were friendly discussions, and the negotiations were very amicable. I did that for a short while, and at that time they were then starting the Kuwait Oil Company magazine called Ahl Naft, the People of Oil, and this was going to be a glossy publication for distribution in Kuwait, and they recruited Ibrahim Risk from the BBC to be the magazine editor, and there was another journalist,
Sabri Saman?
No, Sabri was a Kuwaiti. Sabri was initially in the Arabic Language Centre It doesn't matter. He was a Syrian, but he helped Ibrahim Rizk get the magazine going. And then I went back to Kuwait, and they were about to start up, or had just literally started up, a thing called the Display Centre, which was their first, really their first public relations venture apart from the magazine, in Kuwait. And this was really an exhibition of the way in which oil was found, extracted, processed and shipped out of Kuwait. And we had a regular program for school children from the schools in Kuwait coming for a day's visit, during which we'd show them some films of oil exploration. We'd take them around the display centre, showing them the models and the graphics, and we'd then give them lunch and then take them on a short tour of the oil field and the loading port in the afternoon. And that all worked out quite well. And the other thing we did from the display centre, we were responsible for all the visitors that the company had. And there were a large number of visitors. I mean, it was running into 70 or 80 a month from various either commercial people coming to try and sell things to them, or they were journalists or radio broadcasters. And they would come and
I can remember Kim Philby.
Yeah, right, indeed. The other one, I mean, the sort of thing that happened, we had Woodrow Wyatt from BBC Panorama programme, who came out, and I was responsible for looking after him while he was in Kuwait and organising his programme. And he came out with entirely fixed in his mind what he wanted to film and what he was going to say. And he was only interested in film that supported his points of view. He wasn't interested in anybody else's point of view or in taking any other films which might run counter to his arguments about the situation in Kuwait. And that has made me ever since somewhat sceptical of programmes like Panorama, where I don't believe that they are... I mean, they are putting forward a point of view, and they're, of course, entitled to put forward a point of view, but they are by no means objective in their presentation, I don't think. Once again, I suppose I was lucky in that the head of public relations, which had by then become a three-division outfit, there was the press and publications division, which was Ibrahim Rizk and the magazine and the newspaper, and the display division, which was my division, which had the exhibition and reception of visitors and photographic sections, two divisions, not three. And the head of the department, Larry Craig, an American, went on 6 months' holiday, and I stood in for him as head of the PR department, which was a very interesting time. And when I really began to have my arguments with the head office, not with so much with local management, but I went off on the tack, which I firmly believed, that really we were not doing the right thing in trying to explain to the Kuwaitis how we found the oil and how we got it out of the ground and how we processed it and how we shipped it out, when really what the Kuwaitis were interested in was how did we make money out of it and how could they make more money out of it. And this was deemed by London to be totally outside our terms of reference. We were to have absolutely nothing to do with that side of the company's affairs. And frankly, the Kuwaitis weren't terribly interested. They wanted to know what happened to the oil once it left Kuwait and where the money came from. That remained until I left Kuwait remained the Kuwait Oil Company's official policy.